Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Every Sunday morning at 9, join me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Each week we'll be exploring the wonderful world of modern jazz. From hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz, Sunday mornings at 9 on Sheffield Live.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Where no man has gone before.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Poetry in motion. She turned her tender eyes to me. Steamers in the ocean. Sweeter than any harmony. But she blinded me with silence.
She blinded me with silence.
Good morning, morning and welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show's all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio here on Paternoster Road in Sheffield. The workstation, if you know where that is. We'll be speaking to our PG later on in the show. Unfortunately, Dr. Ogo Osamo cannot be with us this week. Normally, he's our guest speaker for the second Saturday of the month. Fear not. All being well next week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. The week after that, every fourth Saturday of the month, indeed, it's Chris Dale. What will he be talking about? It's usually related to ultra-processed food and things like that. First up, we're going to talk about drones.
Yes, seed-scattering drones are being enlisted to revive rainforest and protect biodiversity. The Woodland Trust and the Southwest Rainforest Alliance hope to triple the area of temperate rainforest in Devon and Cornwall from 8% to 24% by 2050. So far, the drones have scattered 75,000 seeds. Rainforest once covers 75% of the area, but 90% has been lost.
All interesting stuff. Next up, Sud's Law, is soap actually good for us? I saw this, I forgot where I got this article from. It might have been Tesco magazine or something.
Yes.
And I thought it's a really fascinating article. So here we go. So it says, did you start your day with a shower? If so, you probably lathered up with soap or shower gel to scrub away the sweat, dirt and detritus of life. But what if, far from cleansing your body, you were doing it more harm than good? Well, during the winter months, cold air and central heating can dry out and irritate skin. And most soaps or shower gels are only going to make matters worse. So our skin's microbiome is a delicate ecosystem made up of trillions of microbes, which are bacteria, fungi and viruses. These microorganisms help to repair the protective barrier of the skin, fight infection and reduce inflammation. They can also train and support the immune defense system, guarding against conditions such as eczema. So using alkaline soaps and gels to scrub off these microbes, along with the natural oils, dead skin cells and sweat on which they feed, disrupts the natural acid mantle, or pH, of our skin. This can make it dry and irritated and even trigger eczema and dermatitis. So, James Hamblin, who was a lecturer in public health policy at Yale University, noticed a difference when he cut back on his use of soap. As I gradually used less and less, I started to need less and less. And that's what he wrote in his 2020 book called Clean, The New Science of Skin and the Beauty of Doing Less. He said, my skin slowly became less oily and I got fewer patches of eczema. Now, James Hamblin also points out that there is a vast and profitable industry out there with a vested interest in trying to sell us all manner of cleansing products. UK soap industry revenues are expected to hit £723 million by 2028. And that's according to the market research company Mintel. So should we chuck out soaps and shower gels? Well, no, says Professor Carsten Flohr, who's a consultant dermatologist at St John's Institute of Dermatology in London. Washing removes dead skin cells and odours. Water alone is not enough to remove dirt, which sticks to the skin. So you need to combine water with a surface active agent, also called a surfactant, which is what basically soap is. However, not all surfactants, which are chemical compounds that trap dirt and grease, are created equally. You need to make sure that there's not too much of a nasty ingredient in there that attacks your natural layer of your skin. And that's according to a consultant dermatologist, Dr. Veronique Bataille. Nasty surfactants often contain sodium lauryl sulfate, which is an interesting one because that's not only found in soap and shower gel, it's found in toothpaste.
Toothpaste, yes.
It makes them lather.
SLS,
we're used to wanting things to be lathery and foamy, aren't we? It's an interesting point. So nasty surfactants often contain sodium lauryl sulfate, which is derived from palm kernel oil, coconut oil or petroleum, and is used to create a lather. A similar ingredient, sodium lauryl sulfate, not much difference in the lauryl and lauryl sulfate, is mild and often better tolerated. Avoid traditional bar soap, Dr. Veronique Bataille advises, and instead look for body washes with lower levels of surfactants, such as those made by Aveeno, Olatum or E45. Glycerin and urea are good ingredients to look out for, according to the skincare guru Caroline Hurrens. They're humectants, meaning they attract water and help the skin hold on to moisture. Body washes that contain these will help moisturize skin instead of simply rinsing every bit of moisture away. So Caroline Hurrens says, the last thing you want is a squeaky, clean feeling. So as well as E45 products, she recommends those by Luna Daily. One of the best things you can do for your skin is to wash less. Every other day is fine, Bataille says, just think of the time you'll save. Think about that next time you go to the supermarket.
Many people tell you that they're your friend. Leave the sure that you're receiving the signals they send. Cause brother, you've only got two hands to lend. Maybe there's someone who makes you move. Some nights they loom up ahead when you're asleep. Days, things on your mind you should keep. Sometimes it's tougher to look than to leave. You better watch out for the skin deep.
Nice track there by the Stranglers, Skin Deep from 1984, can you believe? And we played that because we're talking about, is soap actually good for us? Have a good look at what's on the label before you put it on your skin. And according to some, washing less is better. Who knew? So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week. Another article that caught my eye for lots of reasons, because it's that time of year, isn't it? Sun is shining. How can I get rust off my tools? So nothing is worse than finally having a clear day to get out in the garden and realising the tools you stored away have just rusted. All is not lost. There are some tried and tested methods from bringing them back to life. There's also an old gardener's trick for keeping them sharp and in top condition. Basically, first wipe off any dirt that could be dried on the tools from last year, which is bad. You should be cleaning them before you put them away. Once clean, though, place your tools in a jar or a container big enough to submerge the rusted metal in distilled white vinegar. If your container isn't big enough to fully submerge the items, you can soak a tea towel or something similar in the vinegar and wrap it around the metal. After a couple of hours, you should notice that the vinegar's acid has dissolved the rust. It may be worth leaving them in overnight for the vinegar to work its magic fully. For stubborn spots, you may need to scrub with some wire wool. The article recommends wearing gardening gloves, as this can be messy and you could get a fine metal splinter in your hands, which is a bad thing and very difficult to remove. When the rust is gone, you may need to treat any wooden handles that could have dried out over time. The article recommends wiping them down with boiled linseed oil, which will dry to the touch, unlike olive oil or vegetable oil, which can remain sticky. So get buying some distilled white vinegar and get buying some, well, boiled linseed oil and get those tools clean.
Thank you.
Rusty Cage there by Soundgarden. What a great bit of music, eh? We played that because we're talking about how do you get rust off tools. The answer is distilled white vinegar. And then to look after your woodwork, it's boiled linseed oil. Who knew? Anyway, you are listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, this week's environment update.
Yes.
Oh, am I starting? Yes. So I am. It's been a bit crazy this morning. Never mind. Scientists are launching a space probe to create 3D maps of the world's densest tropical forests to better understand their levels of carbon storage and what should be done to protect them. Bjorn Rommen, who's a mission scientist for the Biomass Project, said, "We don't properly understand what changes are now taking place, partly because we do not have accurate estimations of carbon levels in these forests. The Biomass Project is going to help us get a better grip on those numbers."
According to Emma Pinchbeck, Chief Executive of the Climate Change Committee, richer people should cut back on flights to allow poorer ones to take an annual family holiday as part of efforts to cut emissions. The idea was popular with a 26-person citizens panel convened by the committee, who agreed that families should be able to afford to fly on holiday once a year.
I thought that was an interesting one. Another one's quite interesting as well. When we separate our waste, we imagine we're doing our bit for the planet, but so often this is not the case. Alexander Clapp, who's the author of Waste Wars, has ventured across five continents to uncover the sordid afterlife of our waste, revealing how the global south, which produces many of the raw materials that constitute everyday goods in the global north, becomes a dumping ground once they are thrown away.
Ooh. Coffee needs a cool, moist climate to thrive, which is why it's often grown at elevation. But recent droughts in coffee-growing nations has hit coffee yields hard, with wholesale prices of the Arabica and the Robusta varieties hitting an all-time high in February. Fortunately, botanists at Kew Gardens are on the case and have been working on climate-resistant coffee for some years, a variety called Excelsa, that's E-X-C-E-L-S-A, is just one of a new group of plants which could save the future of our daily cup of coffee.
Interesting, eh? Finally, pollinators are in crisis. Bumblebee numbers fell last year to the lowest on record in the UK, down a quarter on the average for 2010 to 2023. The charity Earthed is asking anyone with a small patch of ground, even as little as a balcony or a window box or even a doorstep, to help by planting it with nectar-rich flowers. Google Great British Bee Challenge for more information.
Like a queen bee's honey, you as sweet as can be. Can't miss. Don't make me wait to feel you warm in
Another great track there, Honeybee, yes, by Stevie Ray Vaughan. That again was from 1984, and we played that because we're talking about the declining bumblebees and the new project, the Great British Bee Challenge. Go and check it out. Just Google it. You listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Before we call RPG, who's waiting, no doubt in the sunshine, sat in his garden, who knows. We're going to talk about a census that puts every tree on the map to help wildlife habitats. So England's non-woodland trees have been mapped for the first time using cutting-edge methods of laser detection and satellite imagery. Scientists at the UK's Forest Research Agency have built a comprehensive picture of trees in urban and rural areas for a groundbreaking map that goes live. It went live early this week, actually. It will allow conservation groups and local authorities to target planting efforts more accurately by pinpointing lone trees that could be connected to nearby wooded areas, bolstering habitats for wildlife. So DEFRA, the Environment Department for the government, or its Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, actually, said this would help support the government's pledge to expand nature-rich habitats and meet its legally binding target to increase woodland canopy to 16.5% of total land area by 2050. So Mary Cree, who's the Forestry Minister, said that street trees improved air quality, marked seasonal shifts, and gave people peace and joy. This groundbreaking new tree census will not only help us better understand our current tree canopy cover, but identify areas where we can create more nature-rich habitats. So the map shows single trees make up 30% of England's tree cover, and they could play an important role in storing carbon, regulating temperatures and mitigating the effects of climate change, such as flooding and overheating in towns and cities. That's according to the government. That's what they hope. They could also help improve health in urban areas by reducing pollution. The automated map can be updated to capture changes in the canopy. Sir William Worsley, who's chairman of the Forestry Commission, said the results are spectacular and will be invaluable to us as we strive to meet our legal target to increase tree planting cover. what a great track. We've played that before. It's so good. It's De Balm or The Tree by Faust, 1973.
Brilliant.
German krautrock, if we're allowed to say that. And that we played that because we were talking about the government census that puts every tree on the map to help wildlife habitats. If you've just tuned in, of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every week on Saturdays or mornings from 11 till 12. You've had enough of listening to us now. All being well, RPG should be on the line. Morning, PG. Oh,
hang on.
Bit of a technical issue. We need to press a button.
Any better?
No. It's one of the other ones. We know you're there somewhere, Paul. We can vaguely hear you. Are you there, Paul? Oh, it'll be because I haven't plugged you in. Oh, the beauties. The beauties of life science. And now I've got a knot in my... I've got a knot... Hello, Paul.
Hello there.
Yes. Oh, if things will go wrong, they can go wrong. I did forget to plug you into the desk. It's been one of those sort of days. But other than that, everything else is working marvellously.
At least a bit better than plugging me into the main.
Well, exactly. Well, you did come in and fix the light switch the other week, so... Well, we've been pressing a few buttons on the desk now. Like, why? Because we vaguely heard you. My fault. Never mind, you're here now.
No worries.
So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, an interesting bit of news from the Allen Institute came out, and... scientists have managed to complete the largest wiring diagram and functional map of the brain to date.
Oh.
Yeah. So I think it's back in 1979, biologist Francis Crick stated it would be impossible to create an exact wiring diagram for a cubic millimetre of brain tissue and the way all its neurons are firing. But since then, team has built, they built a team of more than 150 neuroscientists and researchers, and they've come together in the Machine Intelligence from Cortical Networks project, and that's shortened to MICRONS, or microns, and they've built the most detailed wiring diagram of a mammalian brain to date. And this is a piece of brain from a mouse, which is about the size of a grain of rice. And they published their findings in Nature magazine. And from the data resource, a collection of 10 studies are published together in a special edition of Nature journals. The wiring diagram and its data, which is freely available through the Microns Explorer, come to 1.6 petabytes in size.
Oh.
And they give you a yardstick which says that's the equivalent of about 22 years of non-stop HD video.
Blimey.
From a tiny sort of size of a grain of rice. So I said that it's giving an insight that we've never had to brain function and organisation of the visual system. So the advances published in this special issue are a watershed moment, somewhat akin, they say, to mapping the genome, which we know now is rolling out to things like Splicer and now into medication and remedies through learning about the human genome. So in an era at the moment where we've got lots and lots of people suffering from mental challenges, mental issues, understanding the brain starts to come even more to the sort of forefront. So IARPA is the thing, gave a big investment to this program, and it shattered the previous technological limitations. So it's created the first platform to study the relationship between neural structure and function at scales necessary to understand our intelligence. So this achievement validates our focused research approach and sets the stage for future scaling up to a whole brain level. So it's the first sort of significant step towards mapping the brain. And scientists at Baylor College of Medicine began using specialized microscopes to record the brain activity from a 1 cubic millimeter portion of a mouse's visual cortex. And they did that as the animal watched various movies and YouTube clips. So it's not far from humans, is it? But afterwards, the Allen Institute researchers took that same cubic millimeter of the brain and sliced it into more than 25,000 layers. We're talking about less than a human hair, I think, at that sort of level. And each is 1/400th the width of a human hair, is what they say. Another team at Princeton University used artificial intelligence and machine learning to reconstruct the cells and connections into a 3D volume or a diagram. And combined with the recordings of the brain activity that they'd mapped, the result is the largest wiring diagram and functional map of the brain to date. It contained more than 200,000 cells, 4 kilometres of axons, that's the branches that reach out to other cells, and 523 million synapses, which is the connecting point between cells. And quite often there's a sort of illustration of a spark transferring across synapses that will be creating memory and lots of other things. So, but inside that tiny speck, there's an entire architecture. A senior investigator, I think, Claire Reed, who's a PhD and one of the early founders of electron microscopy connectomics, who brought this area of science to the Allen Institute 13 years ago. It's got all sorts of connections we knew from various parts of neuroscience within the reconstruction itself. We can test the old theories and hope to find new things that no one has ever seen before.
Amazing.
a massive step for a small piece of mouse's brain, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what they say, this the understanding of the brain's form and function and the ability to analyse the detailed connections between neurons at an unprecedented scale opens new possibilities for studying the brain and intelligence. It also has implications for disorders like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, autism, schizophrenia, involving disruptions in neural communication. And they give an illustration which it sort of chimed with me. So if you've got a broken radio and you've got a circuit diagram, you'll be in a much better position to fix it.
Yeah, so, well, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. I think, you know, the parallel now, I think, in modern days is the sort of black box principle with electronic chips, that you've got an input and output, and you kind of don't know what happens in between. So it's an interesting thing. So they're describing this as a kind of Google map or a blueprint for this part of the brain that they've studied. And doing it on a large team scale science requires lots of cooperation. And Associate Director of Data and Technology at the Allen Institute said it requires people to dream big and to agree to tackle problems that aren't obviously solvable, and that's how advances can happen. So it's a great initiative, and it kind of challenges that sort of old sort of saying from Francis Crick that it was an impossible task, and now they've taken a huge step forward, and it looks like it's a great plan for understanding the brain, understanding the connections, and I've been watching a piece on the news this week where young children now are wearing sensor caps while they undertake tasks to understand some of the functions that are happening with their brain. I think the illustration I saw was a young boy and on an iPad-type device, it would flash up an image, and if he touched that image, he'd be rewarded by a smiley, I think. And they started off with flashing the image up on the right-hand side for multiple times, and then they switched, and they were trying to map what happened to his thought processes to not automatically keep hitting the right-hand side, but to switch as things happened in front of him. So if you can imagine where that can take us in science, then we've got lots of things now where prosthetic limbs can be controlled effectively. I mean, it's called mind control, but it's actually picking up these messages and receptions within the brain and transferring those. So if you've lost an arm and you have a prosthetic arm, you have to think through doing the task that you want the arm to do. It then converts that into control for the motors and everything else within the prosthetic arm, but can give you back a functioning arm with taking the control impulses from your brain.
Which is, it's just mind-boggling, isn't it?
It's really astounding, and say, I think I've probably mentioned before, I remember working on a project where they were looking at the development of what they called synaptic helmets for pilots. And famously, I think Clint Eastwood made a film called Firefox, where he's in a plane flying with one of these synaptic helmets, and as he's flying along and another Russian is chasing him, wanting to shoot him down, he's trying to select the weapons in his plane and gets to the point where he goes, oh, no, I've got to think in Russian, not in American. So it's kind of interesting. And a lot of that's been sort of processed now. And a lot of that's also been analysed to feed into artificial intelligence. So some of that are sort of innate adaptabilities they're trying to get artificial intelligence to learn. So it can make decisions at that kind of level, which is amazing. I think realistically, I think one of the other things that talked about was how much music has got to do, and it resonates in the brain.
Indeed, it does.
Great article, I think, back in 2024, and they were talking about an Oscar-nominated film called Maestro about the life of Leonard Bernstein, the American composer and conductor, and it shows him bringing together a choir and orchestra and lots of things, doing, I think it was Mahler's Second Symphony, and this ends up with things like bells ringing and stuff. But what they looked into is why this probably is something that chimes with us, and they said it gives such an emotional impression to us in the first place, and they say it's about the tones and timbre. When organising in a precise manner, can make us swoon or sway. Yeah, and I'll sort of put my hand up to that, because I remember going to see Santana at a place called Manchester Hard Rock, and they played such a great music that I defied anybody to stay static and still. you just got to move to the music in some way. And it's just a brilliant sort of illustration of that. So what they do, they think that probably the answers to our synergy with music go back to evolutionary biology. So the earliest mammals had to rely on hearing and sense of smell as defensive mechanisms. So they were hyper-focused and hyper-attentive. And according to the study, a guy called Whelan, the modern experience of listening to live music can be viewed as a vestige of that primeval adaptation.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, you know, the acoustic cues that you get. And famously, I think there's the cocktail party syndrome, where you can be in a room with loads of people and noise and chatter, and somebody on the far side of the room will say your name, and you immediately lock onto that person's voice and the sort of discussion that's going on around it from that simple trigger of knowing it's your name. And so you're listening to that whole sound stage with your hearing, but your brain can pick out that element.
Yeah, interesting.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, as long as there's not somebody else called your name. But on the subject of brains, I don't know if you saw the, it was a documentary about Clemency Burton Hills. She was a presenter on Radio 3, but she moved to America and she had a catastrophic brain injury, a bleed on the brain. And she went from being a top violinist, presenter, everything, to basically they wasn't sure if she would walk or talk again, let alone play the violin. And, you know, and that was devastating for her.
Yeah.
It was quite a pro, because we used to listen to her on Radio 3 before she moved across to America. We wondered where she'd gone. And then I saw an article, this was years ago, and I thought, she's had this massive, you know, problem. She got massive scar on her brain as they tried to, you know, solve it. It was very, very moving as a documentary. Yes. It's just shows the power of the brain, and she couldn't understand why she couldn't get the words out in the right order.
No, and I think this sort of symbiotic link with music, you see now, I know there's a touring group of people who take music into homes for older people with dementia.
Yes.
And say that, you know, it's amazing. I think a lot of the time in sort of older age or if you've got sort of forms of dementia, they'll undertake what they call reminiscence therapy. I know somebody used to do that from Sheffield Libraries, and they collect together things that might be from those people's past. So I think, for instance, they had a washboard, and they could bring that out, and a copper posher, which was in the old days what you used to do for your washing, was you'd put them in a tub, put your soap in, and then you get this big, looked like a sink plunger, but it's a big mega-sized version that you used to push the washing down up into the soap.
You did? And,
yeah, and then if you got some particularly grubby shirt collars, you'd poke them out and get the scrubbing board and scrub them with some extra soap to get them sparkly and white as well. So you can take those kind of things in to remind people, but also music. I remember sort of visiting a home for the elderly, and they play music of the era that those people might remember. So it used to be songs from the wartime, and slowly it's progressing as the population ages through the eras that you remember. And so I think that they looked and said, mostly in your sort of teenage years, the music you listen to then kind of sets your preferences in later life. So, you know, it's amazing how I mean, the thing that they cite is the music from Jaws and how that triggers an immediate sort of memory and response in
it's
people.
True, yeah.
Yeah, and it used to do with my old cat. I could make that sound and he'd go berserk running around.
It's like hiding behind the sofa when you heard the Doctor Who thing and the Daleks were coming. It's like, oh, no. But it's interesting because the brain, well, it's a phenomenal thing, the brain, until it goes wrong. But people, music's a big trigger, isn't it, for memories and linking those that era, that timeline, to when you heard that piece of music where you were. Same with smell. I think a lot of people can associate a certain smell, maybe a certain perfume, aftershave, certain something that was connected with something significant in their life. And it just shows you how your brain combines all those things together.
Yeah, well, you talk about the lady who sort of couldn't play violin. One of the things that they're doing with people is to take them back to the instrument and get them to make a noise.
Yes.
But one of the things that they're looking for is if you've played for a long time to a high level, you develop a muscle memory.
Yes.
So if you can trigger that muscle memory, you start to flood other things out of the brain that have possibly been sort of trapped. So, and again, a lot of the things like movement of prosthetic limbs when people have got replacement legs and other things is to try and develop that muscle memory and hopefully with these sort of things where they can pick up your brain waves, they can adapt that to a control and improvement on those kind of things as well.
Yeah, so that's exactly what they did with Clemency Burton Hill. They eventually, because she was a top violinist, she'd learnt pieces she knew by heart that she'd spent all her life learning. She couldn't remember them, couldn't play them. They eventually got her in a room, and rather than, they just said, just sit there, pick up the violin, pick up the bow, don't play anything, just pretend, just move it how you would have moved it. Don't put it on the strings. And then eventually they said, just play something, play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star or something, and she did.
Yeah.
And that was just, it was phenomenal. But, you know, that's, for somebody who's been at top of the game to have that sort of brain injury and not be able to do what you could do before must be, well.
Yeah. Well, another thing cited in this study is that listening to Mozart's Sonata for Two Pianos in D Major can help to reduce the frequency of seizures in people with epilepsy.
Interesting. And why is that? Just the sound, the soothingness of it?
Well, I think it's the structure. A lot of the time they talk about the structure of the music because, again, it's a pattern.
Yes.
A pattern that the brain locks onto. And if there are missing pieces, it's what we, it's like trying to get your words out when you're trying to grip, somewhere in the back of your mind is the words you want to use and you're grabbing for that.
Sadly, the older you get, Paul, that just happens, doesn't it? It's like, oh, I can't remember that. But
absolutely. Now, I've got a terrible thing now where if somebody suddenly asks me a direct question when I'm on something else, it just flushes my brain out of what I should answer.
It's a bit like, I remember on The Simpsons once, Homer Simpson saying his brain was so full that if anything else came in, something had to fall out the other side. But somehow, I don't know, I'm not sure Homer Simpson's brain was ever that full, to be honest.
No, it's just,
there's no room in the warehouse. What did Dave Bowers said? There's no room, you know. I can't remember what the lyric is now. Yeah. My head's like a warehouse. It's got no room to spare.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's it's a common experience for us all. And as you get some insight into these things, you can start to see the potential for curing a lot of issues, helping people. I mean, there are a lot of things where people have had a major sort of impact on their brain and have lost a significant portion of brain, And they've actually, over time, managed to relearn a lot of activities that they'd lost. So, you know, the brain can be very, very adaptive. So you've got connections, and I say quite often we're seeking a connection back to something else, and it may not be the same route that we took initially. But it's why a lot of the time things like smell and sound can relate to, you know, you walk into a bookshop and you go, oh yes, that smell, you know, that sort of kind of slightly fusty,
yes,
book smell you get. So, you know, that can trigger things for people. And looking at old books that you've read, that kind of smell and some of the other things that you do, tactile things, you know, if it's got a particular binding or something else, can all be small pieces in the jigsaw that gets your brain back into the right area. So I just found it incredible that, you know, early days, we've got a first map, and hopefully what we'll see is that building, but also that disseminating through science. And say over 150 bodies got together who specialised in neuroscience to get to this mapping. So if that can be spread out to people quite often, with a lot of new inventions, it's something that comes out of left field. You know, you were thinking about that, but it made you, in the process of chasing something else, think in a slightly different way.
It's all connected, isn't it? And different parts of the brain do different things. I spent a lot of time learning some rather strange languages, two different but very strange languages or difficult languages for English speakers. And because I've not been abroad for quite a while, and I've not, if I was going to those countries, I'd be getting out all my books and I'd be practicing and learning and just refreshing all the words and everything. I haven't done that, but if I start to think now about particular words like a vegetable or something like that, what's that word for that? I often intermix the two languages. So I was thinking, I wonder if this, it's the same part of the brain must process that sort of language retention bit. And because I mix them up, I can't split them sometimes. I think, I sometimes go to one side and one to the other. So I think the brain's a fascinating thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you want to have a dig round on YouTube sometime, anybody who's listening, look for Weird Al Yankovic and his piece called The Brain Song.
Oh, aye. What's all that about then?
Well, he's kind of interpreting the brain through his music, so and if you like, it's a bit tongue in cheek and funny as well. But there's a whole heap of things which are supposedly around the brain. So Blue Oyster Cult did a thing called Veteran of the Psychic Wars, and you sort of look around. Richard Thompson hots for the smarts. So, from all areas of music, Rihanna, Love on the Brain.
Bill Nelson did Do You Dream in Colour?
Yeah.
Which I think is a very interesting one, because I'm sure I dream in colour, but are we really sure?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, madness, it's all in your mind.
I know. Well, the track we've got for you, Paul, is better than that. It's a bit of Emerson, Lake and Palmer. The title of the track is actually Carnival 9, First Impression, Part 2, but otherwise known as Brain Salad Surgery. But finally, Paul, before you go, it's interesting to say, look after your brain and use it. It's like your muscles in your body. It's only if you don't use your brain, if you don't keep it active, that's when you're likely to go into mental decline.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just watching Parliament under full steam now, trying to sort out the problem of the steel industry. So,
if that's not the only thing. Bye-bye, Paul. We've got the film showing now. You're cracking stuff, Paul. Bye-bye. We'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1-3. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Welcome back, my friend. friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
Will you please extend a hand to Alexander's ragtime band, Dixieland?